Thank you. And Mr. Liss, good morning to you. Leader Council have any questions before we begin? Then Mr. Norlinger, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you. I'll try to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel for the appellee, Tim Norlinger, on behalf of the appellant, Minef Al-Kazahi. This case revolves around a motion to suppress and then a stipulated trial involving a breath test. Mr. Al-Kazahi was convicted of a DUI, serious bodily injury, in Lancaster County District Court. The appellant, prior to trial, moved to suppress the breath test in this case, noting that both the attachment 5 and 40-day check used pursuant to Title 177 used a dry air gas cylinder solution that was not on the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's approved product list in violation of Title 177.
That dry gas standard was approved. Is that correct?
It was.
Does Exhibit 1112 indicate that they were approved and would be put on the CPL at a later time?
The stipulation did indicate that they would be approved. However,
not that they would be approved, that they conform to the necessary requirements of NHTSA.
Correct.
But it just wasn't placed on the CPL.
It wasn't on the list. That's correct.
Does that have any impact? Does that have any bearing whatsoever?
I don't believe so, because at some point, obviously, I expect the court and the appellant and the appellee will be talking about method versus technique in this case. The appellant takes the approach that this is method, because ultimately, in order to place this instrument into service, one has to use attachment 5. And then to keep that instrument in service, one has to do 40-day checks. And that goes directly to the scientific method behind the court system that is embedded into the data master that's used here. Certainly, I will concede that what the court just said. However, Title 177 makes clear that the calibration equipment must be on the NHTSA list. And that goes directly to the scientific validity of the test. Furthermore, I would point out the state made a choice to use the dry air gas solution when, as is evidenced by the stipulations of the parties, there are numerous other both wet and dry gas solutions that the state could have purchased in order to properly calibrate it and comply with Title 177.
So are you suggesting then that the failure of using the dry gas standards that were not on the CPL is that foundational, or is that to the heart, the heart backup? Is it foundational, or is it weight and credibility?
So I would say that it goes to method, and that is because it's foundational, because in order to place the instrument into service and in order to maintain it, one must conduct certain scientific tests to make sure that it's in proper working order. And Title 177 also dictates that those tests should be done using solutions that are on the NHTSA approved list. So, to the court's point, obviously technique and method are both defined in Title 177. Method goes to the principles of analysis and refers to the argument or the language lab method, and that's under Title 177, Section 100.16. Technique is under 177, Section 100.21, and talks about a set of instructions for procedure, equipment, and preventative maintenance. The dry air gas solution, as I've stated previously, to me fits within method because it is a principle of analysis. In order to use the data master, the state must conduct an initial test, which is then completed. The checklist is on attachment 5 in Title 177, and that requires that they use a breath test that is conforming to the product list in this case. That is fundamentally scientific to make sure that this instrument is in proper working order.
And is the dry air gas solution used in a test of blood, breath, or urine, as referred to in Section 66201, or something else?
Well, I would say, it is not the blood, breath, or urine, obviously, because in those instances, you're talking about blood drawn from the individual, breath placed into the data master quartz chamber, or the urine that's provided for a DRE evaluation. However, in order to ensure that the machine is acting in proper working order, the dry air gas solution is the only way that the state has to test and make sure that the quartz is in proper working order.
It's used to test the machine that does the test that's referred to, correct?
Correct.
And so does that inform our analysis at all?
I think the appellant's contention would be that it is scientific. As I've stated previously, I believe that you have to certify the instrument as properly working by doing attachment 5, and then to maintain it, it has to be tested every 40 days. So the only scientific way to ensure that this is in proper working order and that it can then be placed in front of a trial court for purposes of Title 177 is to do these, and again, the appellant's contention is that it goes directly to the scientific method of verifying the internal quartz standard. I will note that this court has found that almost anything short of the observation period in 15 minutes refers to, as Justice Funk put, it goes to the weight versus admissibility. However, the appellant's contention in this case is, again, that this is so fundamental to the proper maintenance and operation that it should be foundational and not go to weight. I would point the court to State v. Rodriguez. It's an appellate case, 18 Nebraska, Appellant 104, 2009. State v. Kubik, K-U-B-I-K, 235 Nebraska, 612, 1990. And I would juxtapose that with State versus Cash. It's 3 Nebraska, Appellate 319, 1995. I think those first two cases talk about what is technique. The last case talks about what is method and differentiates between them more fully than I have time to discuss in oral argument. But again, it would be the contention of Mr. Al-Khazahi that in this instance, the machine was never properly placed into service because it did not use a conforming product, and therefore it is foundational in nature. I'm going to reserve my last 2 minutes, but additionally, I would note there is an excessive sentence argument in this case. The court did impose the maximum sentence. While it's within the statutory guidelines of the sentence, we would suggest, based on the pre-sentence investigation and the record of the appellant, that that was excessive. We would ask the court to consider that. I will not mention it any further than to note that it is alleged and it is in my brief. So I will reserve the rest of my time at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
Morning. It pleases the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the state of Nebraska. I had prepared comments here, but I think we're all on the same page, so I'm just going to try to cut to the chase here. The dispute here, of course, revolves around the third foundational requirement of admission of chemical tests, i.e. whether the test was properly conducted under the methods set by the Department of Health and Human Services, or Title 177. What we have here, and really what we have in almost all these cases where we have a challenge involving Title 177, is two completely opposing arguments being made. The defense is arguing that any defect, any failure to comply with Title 177 renders it inadmissible per se under the third foundational requirement, and the state responds with arguing that, well, no, it's weight versus admissibility. As long as we have complied with the method, then everything else is technique, and it's just credibility and admissible. I don't think either position is necessarily correct, at least not categorically correct, and I think it would probably be helpful to move away from this method versus technique dichotomy, which I think is what this court alluded to in State v. Yasa. And if that's the direction you intend to go or keep going, I'm in agreement with that, but I think it would be helpful to revisit the foundational requirements for admission of chemical tests, and in particular to address this third foundational requirement and explain what it means or does not mean.
Can I go back to like the code and the administrative rules associated with all this testing? Is there anything in the code that would require this court to use the language of method and technique?
Anything in the, in our state statutes, you mean?
Yeah, or the administrative code to detail how to do these tests.
I don't know that anything would require you to do that. I mean, within our state statute, 60-6201 has both method and technique in there. I mean, both of those terms are used in the state statute. Obviously, they're used in Title 177 as well.
Right.
And we all know what those definitions are in our case law. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm not even asking you to overrule any cases. I'm just pointing out that I think we've hit a point where we have this continued litigation and we see this continued response of method versus technique, and oftentimes it's just not even fitting or appropriate, in particular when the state is using it, because it's often being used as just this notion that if we complied with the method, everything else is fine, it's just credibility, and that's not necessarily true because we have foundational requirements that have to be satisfied.
Okay, to get into that pigeonhole.
Right.
Okay.
So
right.
I was foundation satisfied here.
Well, here, well, first and foremost, the challenge here was to the third foundational requirement. They didn't challenge that, they didn't allege, you know, under the first foundational requirement that the machine wasn't working properly at the time of testing. They could have gone that it could have alleged that they didn't. And I think the record clearly reflects that it was working properly. It was working properly at the time of the checks before and afterward. The maintenance officer would have attested that it was, in his opinion, it was working properly. There's nothing wrong with the solution. The NHTSA letters confirm that. So instead of coming under the first foundational requirement trying to challenge the reliability or the accuracy of the machine, which they were going to lose on, they instead tried to come in. I'm not attacking Mr. Nolan here. I'd be making the same argument he is if I were handling this case from his end. But what we often see in these cases is they instead come under the third foundational requirement and try to say that any defect whatsoever under Title 177 renders this whole thing inadmissible per se.
So if they'd use a solution that was not NHTSA approved and not on the CPL, where would that have put us?
Well, that would, assuming that we're challenging the accuracy of the machine, the propriety of the maintenance calibration, whether the machine was properly calibrated and functioning at the time in question, we would have to take a hard look at that under the first foundational requirement, and the trial court would have to look at the evidence and determine whether it satisfied that sufficient foundation is laid to establish that the machine is working properly, and if it's not convinced, then the test is out.
So in this case, we don't have, we're using a solution that has been approved by NHTSA. It just doesn't land on the CPL.
Correct.
So what, is there a foundational issue because of that?
No, we would submit there's not. First and foremost, again, that they didn't even come in under the first foundational element and challenge it in that nature. And the district court noted that as well in its order and said there is no dispute here that the first, second, and fourth foundational requirements are satisfied here. We're talking only about the third, which is that the test is conducted in accordance with the methods established by DHHS. But I guess to further answer your question, no, I, when we look at the fact that this solution is in fact approved, it was found to be suitable to maintain and calibrate these machines, even if we were evaluating this under the first foundational component of was it shown to be working properly at the time of the testing, I would submit that the record reflects the answer is yes, it was, so that we would not have a concern here anyway. But again, we're not under the first foundational component here, we're under the third, and we would submit that I think that it would be very helpful for purposes of these cases being handled at the trial level and on appeal for that third foundational requirement to be clarified, and in our position, it's our contention that it means exactly what it says, that the test is conducted in accordance with the methods set forth by Title 177. That's not referring to the entire history of the machine. It's the test. Is it conducted
to the
methods? I'm sorry?
That's the device?
Right. Well, the third foundational question is the test. So, yes, I mean, it's looking at the test in the nature of the device. And basically, if you have used the right device and done the right method, then the third foundational requirement is satisfied.
So we're going back to the issue of the right method.
Well,
so do we have to talk about method? Is the method relevant?
I guess what I'm asking this court to do is take one step back for purposes of clarifying this third foundational element and explain what method means in this context for the sake of taking two steps forward and for future cases not having to deal with this dichotomy.
What does method mean? I mean, there's a definition of method.
And I think it means precisely what Title 177 says it means, that it's just the name of the principal analysis.
The device or the scientific process used. Is that correct?
Yes.
And Mr. Olinger suggests the scientific process includes testing the machine and using the correct solution. That's not the scientific process?
That's not the name of the principal analysis or the device used for that process. If you want to challenge the maintenance and calibration of it, you can certainly do that under the first foundational component. And if we're going to lay foundation, we got to satisfy that foundational component. So that factors in, but as far as what the third foundational component is, I don't think that factors into it. I don't think that is a factor in it. And I think that's the continued problem and the continued reason we're seeing all this litigation with Title 177 is that when you look at virtually all these cases over the last 5-10 years, almost all of them come in under this third foundational component, because we aren't seeing problems with the machine, so they aren't coming in and challenging under the first foundational prong and saying, hey, this machine isn't reliable. They're coming in under the third foundational prong and saying, as long as we can find some defect, no matter how minor, under Title 177, then we can argue that it's categorically, that the result is categorically inadmissible. And that's the problem. And I understand the nature of the challenge. I'm not trying to say that they can't raise challenges, but to the extent we are seeing this over and over and we get stuck in this method versus technique dichotomy, I think that is the source, that is the reason why. And so we're asking you, respectfully asking you to clarify that, and I think...
So under your position, what are the methods approved by DHHS?
Well, if you're talking about PBTs, it's going to be the fuel cell analysis with the approved devices. If you're talking breath tests, it's going to be infrared absorption with the approved devices, data masters, intoxilizers, and intoximeters. And if you're talking blood tests, it's gas chromatography, enzyme dehydrogenase, and one other one that I...
These are set out in either statute or the code?
In Title 177, yes, they're set out.
And if the state use something that's not listed there, if they say, well, we found it with a magnifying glass, that's a method that's not approved.
Yeah, the test results out. Right.
So what do we say in state of Jasser or Yasin? How do we decide that case?
Well, Yasa dealt with an alleged deficiency with the 15-minute observation period, and this court ultimately found that the 15-minute observation period was complied with, so there was no violation of Title 177 in that respect anyway. But alternatively, this court digressed to know the history of method versus technique and the fact that the district court had relied on it in that case, as did I, and noted that we typically don't, and I think what the opinion was saying is that we shouldn't necessarily get into that unless we've satisfied the foundational requirements. And what I'm saying today is consistent with that. I'm asking you to take another step in that direction, but before we do that, I'm just asking you to clarify the third foundational component and what it means or what it does not mean. And then I think we're up and running with what YASA says. I'm in agreement with the direction that this court appeared to be going there. I think that will help streamline things. But anyway, I guess that's the answer to your question in terms of what you said. Just briefly, I only have a few seconds. As far as State v. Cash cited in the appellant's brief, I do believe if this court agrees with our interpretation, I believe State v. Cash is wrong and should be overruled. And looking at other cases, I didn't see anything else that needs to be overruled. I'm not asking you to overrule any other precedent with respect to method and diverse technique. And I say I'm out of time. Just briefly on the excessive sentence claim, Mr. Norlinger indicated that the defendant got the max in this case. Unless I've missed something, that's not true. Class 3A is punishable by 3 years and 18 months post-release supervision and a 15-year revocation. And in this case, the defendant, again, I apologize if I'm wrong, but my notes here indicate he got 18 months with 18 months post-release supervision and an 8-year license suspension. So we're actually talking about half of the maximum sentence, if I'm looking at this correctly. I'm out of time. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes, 18 seconds.
There you go. 2 minutes and 18 seconds, Mr. Norlinger.
Thank you. Mr. Liss is correct. It wasn't the maximum sentence. Counsel got his wires crossed. He misremembered and didn't write it down in his notes, so I apologize about that. I'll submit that issue on the brief. With regard to Mr. Liss's argument, Title 1, essentially the appellant is asking the court to find that Title 177 means something. As I understand the state's argument, that as long as you blow into a fuel cell analysis device for a PBT or a data master that's approved, that satisfies the method. The state doesn't have to necessarily wait 15 minutes. They don't have to use the right solution. They may even miss the 40-day check. At some point, there has to be a bar to allowing for it, and it goes beyond weight and admissibility. Whether this case rises to it, I will submit that as an issue for this court. However, I think the state's position is just untenable, especially when you consider individuals accused from crimes versus the government and the ability of them to afford and to contest with experts and other issues.
So this was brought only under subsection 3.
Correct.
So you're not contesting that the data master was in proper working order?
No, and I think I would concede the stipulations that were filed by the court.
It seemed to indicate that.
Yeah. There's, other than the fact that this was, there was nothing based on this trial counsel's review of the maintenance, there's nothing else at issue in this particular test.
Merely the failure to have that on the CPL?
Correct.
You know, the CPL hasn't been updated since?
2012.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
With that, I don't have anything further. I thank the court.
Thank you very much, counsel. That concludes arguments in State versus Al-Khazahi. So you are excused, and the court is adjourned.